Reasons to be cheerful, part three.
Welcome to the first Film Weekly of a new decade. I'm Jason Solomons. And just when you thought it was time to detox, along comes Andy Serkis with sex and drugs and rock and roll. Yes, Andy inhabits the skin and withered limb of the late Ian Dury in a new biopic. We'll be discussing punk rock and Gollum with Andy Serkis. Speaking of dangerous living, I'll be talking to Andrew Thompson, co-director of Mugabe and the White African, a documentary following the courageous battle of one white Zimbabwean farmer against the brutality of the Mugabe regime. Zan Brooks and I will be reviewing the new adaptation of The Road, and we'll be looking at sexy Meryl Streep in It's Complicated. We'll also be announcing the winner to our New Year's Le Donc and Scorsese competition. Yes, it's another reason to be cheerful. It's Film Weekly. Quietly building a career as one of Britain's most versatile and explosive acting talents is Andy Serkis. From fleeting appearances in Mike Leigh movies such as Career Girls and Topsy Turvy to a brilliant Gollum and King Kong for Peter Jackson, Andy now bursts onto our screens in the guise of jazz punk warrior Ian Dury, channeling the spit and fury of late 70s Britain, the pubs, the clubs, and the drugs.
Don't you think how lucky we are? Great big house and a pool and record, number one in the hit parade. That'll make you happy.
You need sleep, Ian.
You know, plenty of time for a sleep when you're dead.
Last chicken in the shop. Bit juicy. Golden goosey. And I am cooked.
And I'm delighted to say that Andy Serkis joins me in the Film Weekly studio now. Happy New Year and welcome to Film Weekly, Andy.
Happy New Year, Jason. Nice to see you.
What a fantastic way to start with sex and drugs and rock and roll. I mean, that's kind of how I ended my New Year, actually, to be honest with you. But, you know, I'm not going to reveal my private life to you. But, I mean, what a great start for this blistering performance of yours to kick off. Like, I mean, it's already the best British film of this year.
Well, we've had all 6 days of it and I'm delighted to be part of it, yeah.
It is a fantastic performance, Andy.
Thank you.
Was it something that you were fighting for, this? Because I mean, people said when you did Gollum, everyone said, well, you was born to play Gollum. I mean, seeing this, you weren't. You were actually born to play Ian Dury.
I think I probably was more born to play Ian Dury than Gollum. I mean, this project's been on the cards for about 3 years, and it came about basically because Paul Virag, the writer, and myself, who are very old friends, and we've sort of been trying to put stuff together for a long time, were sitting in the Blue Posts pub in Soho and went, God, wouldn't it be great to do a film about Ian? You know, no one's done one. You look at the kind of the 70s music scene, and actually there's one blistering, as you say, kind of character that stands out, a unique voice, and no one's channeled it yet. And it so happens that it kind of coincides with 10 years since his demise this year. Not that we were thinking about that, but I suppose he represented for me all the things that are, you know, incredible about a live, challenging act, a unique voice, someone who's not afraid to stand up and say what he feels.
Did you go and see him live?
I never saw him live, but I did meet him once.
Right.
He was going to write the music for... I was going to do an adaptation with Max Stafford-Clarke, who used to direct at the Royal Court Theatres. He was doing an adaptation of Sue Townsend's The Queen and I, which is a story about the Queen being rehoused on a council estate in Leicester. And Ian was going to write the music. And he came up to Leicester with Mickey Gallagher from the Blockheads. And we had this really awkward, you know, he's always been a bit of a hero of mine. And he was in one of his obnoxious moods and in a Chinese restaurant and kind of really not very pleasant to anybody. And then he got hammered and then just ended up on the pavement. And Mickey Gallagher was like, that's it, I'm not doing it anymore.
There are so many of those scenes in your actual film.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Were you worried? Because, I mean, I would be nervous if I was like you going, well, I want to do Ian Dury, but we'll never get the Blockheads to play. We'll never get Chas Jankel to kind of agree to give us the rights, etc.
That's right. I mean, it was at first, I think that everyone was, you know, he is such a unique person and everyone was very afraid of a story being told about and that was going to sanitize him or sort of, you know, dumb him down or not have the rough edges and the dynamics of him and the exacting person that he is. I mean, he's a truly challenging human being. And this was the point, really. We didn't want to do a normal rock biopic. Yeah. We wanted it to represent his energy, his feel, his kind of anarchic kind of energy, and his visual style and his juxtaposition of imagery and so on. So we didn't want to do, you know, he was born in 1942 and then he died in 2000 and everything in between. It was picking a specific time and a specific relationship, and from that kind of was the family tree, and then everything kind of came off that. And we wanted it to feel like a live Blockheads gig.
Are you an honorary Blockhead now?
I think I might be.
Because the music in the film, Andy, is done by Andy Serkis and the Blockheads.
Well, that's right.
How cool is that?
No, it was, you know, it is kind of why you do the job. It's just yeah. to have those kind of experiences as an actor is absolutely why you do the job. And I was really fortunate. We pre-recorded back in February last year. You know, I found myself standing with two days to record 18 songs and the real Blockheads in the room and me about to start singing Wake Up and Make Love With Me and thinking, oh my God, I've asked for this and now I've got it. And how, you know, and it was very,
because
very,
they're very tight. I mean, not only a tight unit because they've been together for so long, 30 years, I guess, nearly. Yeah, yeah. But they're also, you know, they are tight instrumentally. They are a tight, phenomenal, you know, funk workout kind of group.
And they've lost none of it.
I wasn't even sure. I was thinking, is it injury? Is it Andy Serkis? I just didn't know. It is that good. I'm not saying that because you're here, but is it hard to do an impression of it? Did you want to get an impression of it? Or have you always wanted to get up and do this impression that you had?
Well, you know, the thing is, the lyrics are so brilliant. And well, there's two things. I think our vocal range is similar. There's,
right.
So that was, I was lucky enough to, that was for free.
Because he's not
a
singer, is he?
He's not, he's certainly not, and never thought of himself as one. And it was all about delivering the lyrics in a interesting and challenging and, you know, edgy way, making people think. And it's in a very kind of cabaret Brecht kind of, you know, music hall way. I mean, music hall was his passion, and he drew from all of those guys, you know, Max Miller and all of those guys, and Max Wall was his hero. Mm. So, I mean, and I've always had a bit of there are a lot of crossovers, I think, kind of from where he comes from in terms of a performing artist. Not that I'm a lyricist, but I studied visual arts before I became an actor, and I've always, when I approach characters, it's often through a visual sense, and I do a lot of drawings and sketches you know, have very visual ideas about, I mean, like, for instance, the costuming and how we went about that with Joanna Eatwell, who did a brilliant job of managing all of the looks, because Ian had a billion looks.
He was an artist struggling always up until his death about his look, wasn't
absolutely.
It? I mean, that was important to him.
Really, I mean, everything, his sartorial elegance was part of his expression. And
I just want to talk a bit more about you as an actor and the craft involved in a performance like this. And one's been so used to sort of the physical aspect of you from King Kong and from Gollum. Very interesting you mentioned that Ian Dury's hero is Max Wall, because there was the character you did in Topsy Turvy for Mike Lee.
Absolutely.
He was a dance teacher,
well,
wasn't he?
Well remembered,
yeah.
John Doban, the choreographer.
What was his name?
John Doban. He was the choreographer of all the Savoy Ballet.
Right. It reminds me that he walked a bit like Max Wall, didn't he? He had that funny little walk.
That's
that
right.
Did.
That's right.
Was it a Max Wall?
It was, yeah, yeah. It was all based on that. Okay. Well remembered.
Wow.
Yeah.
See?
Actually, because there was that Victorian eccentric dance movement, which then kind of led into all the, you know, all the review stuff, all the variety stuff of the 50s and that Legmania was a form of dancing.
And that's what you were teaching. Well, brilliant. Because the physical side of it is very interesting. I always thought you were an actor that kind of done the mime kind of entrance in it, the Lecoq Gollier kind of school of stuff. But no, that's not your route in.
It's not, actually. No, it's more, as I say, a sort of visual sense. I mean, when I was at I went to college to I went to Lancaster University and studied visual. I went to there to study visual arts, and then in my first year I had to do a subsidiary course, and the theatre studies department looked really amazing, and it had a great theatre space.
And
you know, absolutely, I wasn't going to say that, but why not? I sort of crossed over gradually, but I was designing sets and posters, and then started getting into performing. And there was one play that I did called Gotcha by Barry Keefe, which is part of a trilogy called Gimme Shelter. And that was my route into acting. And I played this, and it was a really consuming, all-consuming role. And I just went, that's it.
Did he write The Longer Friday, Barry Keefe?
Yeah, I think he did.
Exactly. What era are we talking about?
This was the early 80s.
Very much Ian Dury time. time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you were kind of having him on, he was on the radio or wherever he was on John Peel's
sessions.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah,
and you were
sure.
doing all this. Very fascinating. You're the first actor that I know that sort of says he sketches his character. You come in from that sort of route. So what do you do? You read the character on the page when you get it and you're already doodling what he might look like?
Yeah, and I draw a lot from our kind of artistic influences. For instance, with Gollum, you know, I was very, very influenced by Egon Schiele and Francis Bacon and Otto Dix and George Groats. And just I collect images, I suppose, and then I sort of Photoshop them together in my mind, and that kind of helps.
Do you have
me.
A mood board, like a sketchbook that you've actually kind of put together?
Yeah. I mean, with computers, it's even better because you can muck around for hours, really. But no, I do work like that. And then
do you know others to do that? I mean, or is this just something you
I think
come
Anthony
to?
Scher, people like Anthony Scher, definitely. He's an. I mean, he's a proper artist. Mm. I mean, he paints. He's a fine artist. And I know a number of actors do paint actually, but. But it's for me. It's more. Which is kind of why I'm. I mean, this was also this project was also a sort of a sideways step in another direction, which is sort of inhabiting the whole piece.
Yeah, because you're executive producer on this.
That's right, and shaping that and having a kind of a say. I mean, and that was again one of the joys of this job. All the energy was pointing in the right direction. The director, the writer Paul Virag, was my close friend, as I say, you know, we all felt we were pushing in the same direction with the film and had similar tastes and it was a very free environment to collaborate on.
Yeah, I mean, I loved it. It was very British to me. It was very London. It seems to be as well. I mean, having enjoyed Control as a biopic, but it's about North for me, this was really smelt and felt and was London. Absolutely. Old London, South End, all that kind of stuff.
That's right.
It all kind of poured together. What do you think that say an American audience would make of it? I mean, I think
it's
they would
good
be.
Good question.
It's very specific, and my feeling is that because it's so specific, they might just think, "What a weird world! It's wonderful." There's no concessions in there, as you would expect from Ian Dury. There's no kind of like, "Oh, let's do something for the American audience."
No, absolutely not. But having said that, I mean, 24-hour Party People. I know is a pretty much a cult movie in the States. So I mean, I think it'll. I think because of the sub. I mean, that's quite challenging because it's the form on 24-hour Party People is very fractured, and there's elements of that.
Absolutely.
In this. But I think the emotional heart of this story is something that is a universal story, and I think if it's placed correctly, and we can somehow. I mean, Ian only ever went over to America once, and he toured with Lou Reed, and they fell out hugely.
God, I wouldn't mind being backstage with those two.
I know. So I think it's about educating the music in the American audience to the music first, and then letting
which
them,
is interesting because it's got the punk sensibility, but it has this I think wonderful kind of funk.
Absolutely.
I mean, it really is kind of New York funk.
No, it
kind
really
of stuff.
Is absolutely. No, I think okay. I mean, it is kind of Steely. It's got a little bit of Steely Dan.
Absolutely,
in
there, yeah. Now, one of my and Chas Janko, obviously, when he I Know Corrida and all that. It's a brilliant kind of. Was it Michael Narod and Walden actually had a
that's
hit
right.
with it? And,
that's
but
right.
it's actually a Chas Janko tune. Let's fight for the Stanmore boy.
And Chaz lives up the road from me, and we've actually become really, really close friends. Really, and he's a big jazzer, and I play tenor sax as well. So,
do you?
In fact, on the hell of you know, on the score, there are some jazz segments which I play tenor sax on.
Really, yes, Andy Serkis.
Been dragging out all the old talents.
Absolutely. Now, you were wonderful in Little Dorrit recently as well. Scared the living daylights out of me every time you came on the screen, which I noticed has got a Golden Globe nomination.
That's
as
right.
best. I think it's a mini series or something.
That's right.
Terrific. But you're soon off to. Shouldn't you be in New Zealand or something? Are you doing The Hobbit?
The Hobbit is definitely happening. It's happening this year. The scripts are being written, the first part's been written. I think the second part's being written.
And Gollum's in The Hobbit, is he?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
So I imagine at some point I'll be hoofing back to New Zealand, which will be great. Yeah,
right.
No, I'm looking forward to it, and to work with Guillermo. And in fact, when I was there.
Because that's going to be very different, isn't it? I mean, having worked with Peter Jackson doing your first character, then to
that's
now
right.
go with a different director, is he taking Gollum in a different direction? Or you're still
no
using the
idea.
Same technologies?
Yeah. No, I mean, Gollum will look like Gollum, I imagine. I really don't know.
Can you still get in those positions, all that bending
it's
crouching? You're getting old.
It's 10 years since we've, you know.
You're going to put your back out.
Oh, I know. We'll see. We'll have to see. But he was I was down there filming Tintin recently and met with Guillermo, and we talked about it, and we've got very excited about it.
I just wanted to say before we go, Gollum, I think, was the kind of the most kind of achieved that performance capture had been before this. Oh, now Avatar is obviously
absolutely.
Kind of...
I've just seen it.
You've just seen it. Oh. I mean, it's kind of what you were doing, isn't it?
That's exactly what we're doing. And it's slightly... I mean, it's amazing to see the development, and I think Avatar's an extraordinary piece of work. I really do. I think it's fantastic. And the acted performances by the guys who are Zoe Saldana and Sam Worthington, when they become their Avatar characters, is beautiful.
Absolutely.
And I hope people
begin to
understand.
I mean, I've never fancied anyone with a tail before, and I thought she was just gorgeous.
I did. I just hope people begin to understand. They still find it hard to realise kind of how it... the technology thing is still a thing to get their heads around, but I think it's really important, an important step for the public to understand that it is acting, and that it is just another way of clothing a character. And yes, obviously, visual artists are employed in a huge way to enhance the performance, but the actual root of the performance is driven by an actor, and that's something that I still struggle to explain to people 10 years after.
Well, I'm glad you're here to do it, so that the death of acting has been greatly exaggerated.
Oh, God. What's that about? I mean, that's so Luddite. People, even actors, they're like, oh, gosh, yes, we're going to have work taken off us, And it's like, no, this is enabling you to play anything you like. You can be 75 years old and play the Juve lead if the director's got that much imagination.
Got the imagination. Well, you certainly, you're brilliant in the flesh, as Ian Dury, in Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, and for your kind of, your stand for acting in the future as well. Much passion, Andy Serkis. It's brilliant to have you on Film Weekly as the first guest of 2010.
Oh, fantastic.
Really love to see you. And I hope in the next decade you'll come on many more times.
Cheers. Thanks, Jason.
And Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll will be released across Britain from Friday, January the 8th. Joining me for the first time this decade to review the week's releases is Guardian critic Zan Brooks. Welcome to 2010, Zan.
Older and wiser.
Has it been a good decade for you so far?
It's been a great decade.
Absolutely. What do you think the decade in film's going to bring us?
I think it's going to bring us lots more films by Nancy Myers, who's made It's Complicated this
lots
week.
More films in 3D as well, I should think, because as we speak, Avatar, not only is the snow amassing outside, but Avatar is snowballing all before it.
It's incredible, isn't it? It's been out for like 3 weeks, and already it's the fourth most successful film in history.
I know.
Is it that good?
I feel bad because we had a little break. We talked about Avatar briefly. We sort of dealt with it and we said, well, it was good. Is it this good?
I'm sort of hung by my own previous words in that I think I actually said it probably wouldn't be as big a hit as Titanic. And already I've screwed up this decade.
what a false start you've made. Zan, this week we're going to look at The Road, directed by John Hillcoat, Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, starring Andy Serkis, and It's Complicated, directed by Nancy Myers and starring Meryl Streep. Let's start with The Road. We have sort of talked about The Road before because, of course, it premiered at the Venice Film Festival back in September, where you were. I didn't catch it there. I caught it at the London Film Festival. And now here it is, The Road. Zan, before you give me your arm, old toad, and we travel down this road, let's hear a clip of John Hillcoat's The Road.
Would you stop sulking? He's gone.
Gone.
What do you want me to do?
Just help him, Papa. Just help him. He's just hungry. He's gonna die.
He's gonna die anyway.
I'm so scared.
I'm scared. You understand? I'm scared. You're not the one who has to worry about everything. What? What'd you say?
Yes, I am! I am the one!
There I was, invoking Larkin. This has the bleakness of Larkin, doesn't it? But of course it's based on Cormac McCarthy's novel. Is it a successful transition from novel to screen?
I think it is. I think the bar has been set pretty high by No Country for Old Men, which obviously won all those Oscars a few years back. And this had the stench of a troubled production on it from what I was reading before it arrived in Venice. It was shot, I think, like 2 years ago, and it's been kind of kicked around a little bit and pulled around since then. So I was expecting this to be a bit of a failure, and actually I thought that by and large they have done it extremely well.
The reason they were shooting 2 years ago is I think Katrina happened, Hurricane Katrina, and they thought, brilliant, some desolation, real life desolation. Let's go and use it. And I must say that it looks amazing, this film. I was sort of saying that the production design is fantastic, but I think that life itself has provided the production design, which is all the more scary.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? That global warming has been the great production designer of this film. I think very tellingly, the filmmakers have decided not to go for sort of CGI landscapes here, and it's actually shot in the real American ghost towns of the here and now that we're living in. So it's storm-ravaged New Orleans. It's the abandoned Pennsylvania Highway, which is just this sort of road to nowhere. And it's the sort of ghost towns around Pittsburgh where, you know, the economic migrants have all moved away and these houses are all just kind of falling apart. And that makes the film more resonant in a way.
It reminded me, and I think this is probably intentional, I don't know if it's intentional for the novel, of The Dust Bowl, of course, and Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck, of course, and the film version of that. It seemed to kind of tap into that desolation. And perhaps it is a fable for our times as much as that was a fable for those times. And of course, should endure. Will it endure as a film? I think the novel is kind of perfectly kind of cemented already in the kind of public consciousness. Will the film do the same? Will it add to that?
I don't know if it'll add to it. And there's a danger, I guess, in dramatising Cormac McCarthy's writing style, which is incredibly stripped down and honed and every word perfectly weighted. In dramatising that, you risk over-egging it a little bit. And that occasionally this film does that. This has slightly needless flashbacks to sort of pre and immediately post-apocalypse with Charlize Theron as the wife who can't quite cope. It has a voiceover, and normally, voiceovers don't work, and I think it's unnecessary here.
Yeah, but I read that Cormac McCarthy was very insistent
that
voiceover should be in there.
Yes, I'm surprised by that. I'm surprised by that, because I don't think it was needed. It also has what on the face of it is actually a very good score by Nick Cave. But again, whenever the music came in, it broke the spell for me. The whole point
it
of this...
It's whingy, isn't it, the music?
A little bit. And the whole point of it is it's supposed to just take you into this world and leave you there. And it's supposed to be silent and claustrophobic. And each time that you get a voiceover or a flashback or a bit of music, it slightly does lift you out of it.
I think it becomes, it kind of goes into film narrative and you kind of forget about the kind of the kind of leanness of the narrative or the metaphor of the road itself. We're sort of taken off the road. We turn off for a bit. And I think that kind of distracts from it. For me, the film, it's bleak, yes. It's not bleak enough, really. I wanted it kind of really strict, art house kind of Tarkovsky bleak. Do you
possibly
know what I
mean? Yeah, possibly.
And it didn't quite have that. It almost had a little bit of levity. Not levity, no jokes, obviously, but it kind of had this kind of, oh, but I'm going to be uplifting anyway. Yes, I know I'm bleak, but yes, there's essential humanity in there. That, for me, that sort of ruined.
But that's
the
in the book. The humanity is in the book. You've basically got almost like a sort of parable of Old Testament, New Testament, with Viggo Mortensen's character as the Old Testament dad who's stern and hard and a bit savage, and then Cody Smit-McPhee as the sort of the New Testament son who's more generous and kind and shares his meagre rations with the people he meets on the road. So that kind of humanity is in the book too. And if there is a problem with this film, it's duplicated from the book, which is the ending, which the ending of the book I thought was a cop-out and perhaps even a betrayal of what had gone before. And you get that again here.
Zan, let's move on from the road. I think after it, we need a bit of sex and drugs and rock and roll. Ian Dury and the Blockheads.
Sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Does it matter if you don't know who Ian Dury and the Blockheads are, if you weren't around in the early 80s and never heard Rhythm Stick at number one for 6 weeks?
No, I don't think it does, really. I think I have generally a bit of a problem with biopics, because I've always find just by their nature they're a bit kind of pinched and pedestrian. They've got to cover certain ground and things like that. I thought that this had a ramshackle energy and a colour. And if you're too young for Ian Dury and the Blockheads, that's fine, because this takes you back into that world, which is a world that now seems very distant suddenly. I mean, it's the world that we remember as kids. But this is almost like a rock biopic as scripted by Dickens sometimes.
There's no one downloading anything. There's no MP3 players. What there is live performance, which I really liked about that. I thought it captured the sweaty energy and the pull of going to see a performance and a performer, which is what Ian Dury clearly was, and what clearly Andy Serkis is as well, because he captures the spirit.
He does, yeah.
I mean, I'm not particular. I remember Ian Dury on Top of the Pops a lot. I never went to see any of his gigs. Mm. I can't lie that. But I think he captures the energy and the spirit of a true rocker or a true roller or a true kind of of someone who really just wants to kind of grab popular music and grab the kind of medium.
I think that's true. And it doesn't glamorise Dury as well. I mean, he's a bit of a screw-up throughout all of this. So it doesn't airbrush the legend. And you've got the flashbacks to his pretty kind of gruelling time at a special needs school where he's dumped by his dad, Ray Winston, which is a great little performance by Ray Winston as the father.
As the dad. And also at the school head by Toby Jones.
Toby Jones,
well. That's
yeah.
the Dickensian kind of portrait.
Absolutely,
of Britain,
absolutely. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's a good warts and all story, this.
Yeah, very British as well. Is what
very
I liked
British,
about it.
But the British of the past, though, Jason, when I was kind of watching this, I was thinking, you know, the great success of punk and the whole pub rock scene was that it flipped the pyramid a little bit. So the kind of, the, you know, the ugly, pugnacious proletariat at least had a sort of fighter's chance. And watching this, I thought, you know, this man was at number one. Would you have like a self-described cripple with like calipers as your number one act and not be celebrated as a sort of novelty act or a curiosity, but actually just celebrated as an artist?
Maybe.
And I'm not sure that you would now.
I don't, would he get through to the next round on Britain's Got Talent?
Only as the sort of freak show, sideshow thing.
Maybe. But Michelle McManus did it.
Well.
Where is she now?
Well, exactly.
It's complicated, Dan. Let's move on from Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll because we've got Circus and he is just fantastic. Let's talk about Meryl Streep, nominated for the 189th time for 85 performances in It's Complicated. Here she plays a sexagenarian woman who's rediscovering her sexuality with her ex-husband.
He's a complete prick for cheating on you.
I can't disagree with you on that.
And then he marries her? A known lunatic?
Well, she has a big job. Why do you always say that?
Because she does. She runs the whole marketing department at KY, or
whatever that station's called.
She can't be that big of a lunatic. Janie, come on. He cheats on you with her, your 20-year marriage ends, then 6 months later, she leaves Jake and runs off with some random guy, has a baby, then leaves that guy for Jake, and she's not nuts.
Oh, Joe, you are so lucky Jerry is dead.
Thank you.
Dame Lord Queen Meryl Streep there, nominated Golden Globes. She's nominated also for Julie and Julia. She's always very good, Meryl Streep, isn't she?
Well, I think the crown has slipped a little bit here. I'm not quite sure why she did this film. I hesitate to say for the money, but that's perhaps the only possible
perhaps
answer.
Working with Nancy Myers, who I think is interesting about female sexuality. Of course, in Something's Gotta Give, she kind of famously showed Diane Keaton naked at the age of 50-something, and here she is again sort of dealing with women and their kind of body issues at the age of 60. I thought this was rather interesting.
You're right, and there is certainly a major gap in the market for films that respectfully look at middle-aged women and middle-aged women's sexuality. For all that, I thought that this was pretty reductive. These women are basically caricatures, and they seem to be solely defined in relationship to the menfolk.
Well, the ones we heard were, but Streep, surely a better actress, fleshes out her characters
a little
more than it. I mean, the fact that Streep is Streep, it kind of keeps you watching here, I think.
I think Meryl Streep is great.
Diss the Streep on this show.
I found her irritating in this. I thought Alec Baldwin was better.
Yes.
As the philandering, caddish ex-husband. And who does have a kind of charm.
Doesn't
and
he?
There's a sort of bravery to his performance, sort of parading his beer gut and things like that. I thought that his performance was better than Meryl Streep's, and there's not many films that you could normally say that about.
No, that is absolutely true. The Dingo was brilliant in A Cry After Dark.
The Dingo did well.
This is not social realism, is it, Zan, this film? I saw as it started with a kind of beautiful helicopter shot of the happy
world?
California.
What world are these people
living in? This is Santa Barbara, darling.
This is Santa Barbara, where everyone has a huge ranch-style kitchen and an oceanfront terrace. And you've got Steve Martin as the architect who comes to renovate Meryl's kitchen because she's only got two ovens in it. And, you know, who hasn't gone through the hell
she
of only having two
more.
Ovens?
Now, there's a bit where she offers Steve Martin a joint. She has a joint, and I think, can Meryl do stoned acting? Yes, she can. She offers Steve Martin this joint, and he's about to do stoned acting. And I'm thinking, this could be a disaster. I think he actually sort of carries it off all right.
Yeah, they both carry it off all right, but it goes on too long. It's something like 10 minutes of stoned histrionics.
Yeah, the whole film is an indulgent kind of, well, she's a baker in this film, so the metaphor is probably, it's like a big luxury chocolate cake, which you eat a bit of, think it's quite nice, and then you eat a bit more of it and you think, well, that's a bit too much, but I'm going to finish it anyway, and actually I quite enjoyed it.
Did you? I sort of didn't. I found it obnoxious.
I'm a film critic in the body of a 60-year-old woman, that's why.
A 60-year-old woman with a big ranch-style kitchen.
Yeah,
I think that this would be a great double bill with The Road. Because you can, you could have this as the world that we're living in now, or certain people are living in now, and then the road. And if, you know, it tilted into the road, like, you know, they'd all eat each other, wouldn't
maybe
they?
The road
they'd be
leads,
in the ranch-style kitchens.
The road leads to Santa Barbara, because it does go to the coast.
It does, and they all go and feast on Alec Baldwin's big gut.
San, for dumping us back in the harsh reality after the gorgeous quilted love of Santa Barbara, thank you very much indeed. I look forward to the next decade of misery with you.
Thank you.
For all of the best news and reviews about film, just go to guardian.co.uk/film.
Hit me with your rhythm stick. Hit me. Hit me. Das ist gut, sehr fantastic. Hit me.
Let me through the gate.
Is it? So what were you looking for?
I was coming to see where you lived.
And what? And do what?
Well, if you want to steal my house, maybe you can give me your house.
The land belongs to the black peasants. It is ours. The government took it from you people to redistribute it to the black poor majority.
And ministers are the black poor majority. Every time you come in a brand new car. This is
a clip from Behind the Lines there, from the documentary Mugabe and the White African, which traces the struggle by one of the few remaining white Zimbabwean farmers, Mike Campbell, and his near foolhardy attempt to take President Mugabe to international court. Making the film itself was a brave endeavour involving covert filming in a very hostile environment. And to tell me just how risky it was to make, I'm joined by director Andrew Thompson, who, along with his partner Lucy Bailey, made the film. Welcome to Film Weekly, Andrew. How lovely to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
And how lovely to have you safe as well, because by all accounts, for obviously the farmer Mike Campbell and his son-in-law Ben Freeth, this was a very dangerous place to be living, and obviously a dangerous place for you to venture.
I mean, it's a very dangerous film. I mean, obviously, there's a total press ban in Zimbabwe, so to have got caught filming in Zimbabwe would, at the very least, I suspect, have led to us getting arrested and thrown into prison. Lucy and myself have both worked in sort of hostile environments before. We've worked in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I've just recently come back from Gaza. So we're used to working in fairly extreme and fairly hostile environments, but I must say, Zimbabwe was without doubt the sort of scariest of them all.
Especially because you were going to sort of do a long-term project. I mean, I suppose it's all right for a news crew to go in, kind of get do the story quickly and get out. But you had to kind of go in several times. Presumably, you had equipment as well. I mean, what did you say to customs? Oh, we're just you're obviously going there to film. You're carrying an HD camera, I assume.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was always quite important for us that we made a good-looking film. We wanted to make this a cinema film, so it was always going to be very. It was always going to involve taking a larger format camera, proper camera, and proper a cameraman myself, a sound recorder, and his equipment in as well. So yeah, life would have been much easier had we decided to take a small sort of consumer camera into Zimbabwe, and there's no doubt we probably could have got in and out the country as tourists that way, because of course we set ourselves this ambition of making this larger cinema theatrical film. It involved smuggling this larger equipment in, which of course made our lives on the ground considerably more difficult and considerably more risky. Part of our sort of strategy was always to travel separately from the gear, so the gear would go in one way and James Snowden, the sound recordist, and myself, we would travel in another way. So at any point, if we were stopped on along the journey to the farm, on the roadblocks, the various numerous roadblocks, we were always kitless. So we always just had to keep one step ahead of the guys that were trying to catch us.
Absolutely. Well, it pays off having a sort of cinematic look to the film as well, because there are lots of lingering shots of the landscape, beautiful kind of shots of the sky, animals, etc. And I suppose the point of that, and it comes across very well, is to contrast the beauty with the brutality,
with
the kind of idyll that's being shattered here, because Michael Campbell, as a white farmer, he has a dream that's being kind of actually sort of taken to pieces, isn't it? Doesn't he?
Yeah, very much so. No, and I think as well, I think it's very important for the audience to get an understanding of what it is that Mike Campbell and his family and farm workers are fighting so hard to protect. And I think that sense of place is very, very important for an audience to understand just why it is that Mike puts himself through the situation that he puts himself during the course of the court case and the course of 2008.
It's an interesting title, isn't it? Mugabe and the White African. One assumes then that your sympathies as a filmmaker, and therefore ours as an audience at the start, are with Mugabe as a sort of the villain. He's been painted as a demon in the world. And here is Michael Campbell, a white African, which is also, you know, in classical terms, a villain, the colonialist, really. Yeah. Your film sort of turns that on its head in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the title, I think, is a provocative title. And I think the film itself does throw up all sorts of sort of uncomfortable truths about colonial history, about whites in Africa, but also about sort of contemporary African politics. Again, I mean, it's very easy to get sort of sidetracked by the race arguments. Can you be white and African? I think Ben asks in the film, well, can you be white and American, or can you be white and Australian? And of course you can. But certainly in Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe, you cannot be white and African, you cannot be white and Zimbabwean. But I think as well that the larger sort of truths really resonating from the film are less about race. And as I say, it is very easy to get bogged down in the race argument. It's more about sort of three principles by which Mike takes President Robert Mugabe to court, which is democracy, human rights, and the rule of law in the region. I think those are the sort of key pivotal points, really, that the court case addresses to that. And those are obviously universals, black or white.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the sort of beating heart of the film that comes out when you're trying to negotiate this minefield of racism. Because obviously, Mike Campbell, he's a farm owner, a landowner. He has a more comfortable life than, say, the people he employs. He may employ 500 people, but obviously he's better off than them, being the sort of white colonialist. So my sympathies were I found them on very sort of shifting grounds throughout. Even to the point where I kind of wanted to know from the Mugabe side of things why Mugabe was so intent on stamping out this kind of the ghost of colonialism past, if you like. Obviously, you couldn't really get an interview with him because you can't interview anyone out there, I assume.
No, I mean, we did approach the Zimbabwean government numerous occasions and got declined every time. In fact, that sort of last grab of a soundbite you get from Prince Bachar as he leaves court at the end of the film is the only sort of response we had from the Zimbabwean government.
Do they know the film has now come out and that people are talking about it and that it's that it's winning awards and being seen here?
Yeah, I think increasingly they are. I mean, we've had it was always very important for us when taking this film that we would try and get it to politicians, to NGOs, to church groups, and so forth, to those sort of people that are genuinely in a position to make a difference inside Zimbabwe. So we've had various screenings over here in the UK, in the States. We've had various screenings of the films in Europe and the United Nations. And obviously, most importantly, we've had screenings to some of those 14 nations that make up the SADC community. Because I think the solution to Zimbabwe is going to have to come from the side, Africa itself.
Andrew Thompson, for your bravery in that respect, much respect, and for making Mugabe and the White African and giving us that peek behind a curtain we're not normally allowed to see behind, many thanks indeed. An intriguing film, Mugabe and the White African. Thank you very much for joining us on Film Weekly.
No, pleasure.
Mugabe and the White African won Best Film at the British Independent Film Awards shortly before the new year, and that was Andrew Thompson there. The film is on limited release from this Friday, the 8th of January. For more information on the film, do go to the website mugabeandthewhiteafrican.com, all one word. That is all we have for you this week, but before we go, you'll remember that as part of our excellent Best of 2009 podcast, we had a thrilling competition for you to win a signed Le Donc and Scorsese poster bearing the mark of none other than director Shane Meadows. We played you some clips from my In the Director's Chair series, and we asked you to name the voices. They were, in order, Spike Lee, Danny Boyle, Catherine Bigelow, and Ang Lee. We had a great response, and most of you got it spot on, of course, and thank you very much for your very generous comments as you were entering. But the first name out of our Santa's hat was Jeff O'Brien. Your poster and DVD and your mug are on their way shortly. Do pick up a copy of this Sunday's Observer for the best film news and reviews and the return of Trailer Trash, of course. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and Film Weekly's producer, Jason Phipps, it's Happy New Year, goodbye, and we'll see you next week.
Reasons to be cheerful. One, two.